The Has Been Show with me, Martin Beans Ward, the podcast that travels in the back of a van. Hello and welcome to The Has Been Show. On episode 11, we talk to Martin Condon from Martin's World. Martin is a cannabis legalization advocate and campaigner. Now, in this episode, we're going to talk about, I suppose, everything to do with cannabis, why people believe it should be legalized, why I suppose we might look at some of the reasons why it's economically viable, as well as ecologically viable. So, without further ado, welcome to the Has Been Show, Martin. How are you keeping?
I'm very good, no, thanks very much for having me on. It's a pleasure to join you.
No problem at all. I've been following you on Facebook, Martin. You know, it's one of those things that I ask myself the question every now and again, you know, what things in society have a need to change? And normally I'm fighting in around human rights work and, you know, traveller rights or LGBT rights and things like that. But at the same time, there's a little hidden community of people that are I suppose, in need of certain types of medication that's not available in Ireland, and namely cannabis. And recently, the government have said that people that have a need for medical cannabis are no longer being, I suppose, impeded in having that delivered from the Netherlands. And I personally think it's a great adjustment, I suppose. It's definitely a step forward. I suppose, well, what's your take on that? Do you know the recent development I'm talking about?
Yeah, just to correct one thing. You say that there's a small population of people or a portion of our society who would benefit from access to this medicine. I believe there's actually a great portion of our society who would benefit from it. They were to broaden the horizons and the conditions which get access. So currently in Ireland, it's multiple sclerosis, chemo, nausea associated with chemotherapy, and the medicine-resistant type of epilepsy. Those are the three conditions which people can be prescribed medicinal cannabis. Chronic pain has been excluded from that, despite most of the research actually supporting that as being the number one reason why people actually use medicinal cannabis is chronic pain. So there's been a lot of people who would actually benefit from this should the proper legislation be passed. And the recent announcement there in regards to the continued delivery of the medication, that was wrong that this even took place in the first place. Like, we discriminated against these patients and said, yeah, look, you can have access to your medicine, but you need to go collect it from a different country because you can't get it the same route you get other medicines here. So we have one patient, Alicia Maher, who's in Alicante at the moment. She's kind of a medical cannabis refugee from Ireland, living in Spain, because she gets better access to cannabis there. And she kind of recently got a license, but she can't come back to Ireland now because, one, they won't actually reimburse the cost of her medication. It's cost prohibitive. It's cheaper to stay in Spain and get it through the avenues that are there. And two, the spectrum of medicines that are available, it's quite limited currently for patients who get access. There's only one kind of strain of cannabis that they can get access to. So this is a big issue for patients, that they're just being discriminated against. And this recent announcement, while it is good for patients that they no longer have to travel, they should never have had to travel in the first place. To celebrate this restriction, it is worthy of a quick hurrah, a quick celebration, but geez, we're nowhere near the finish line yet in regards to medicinal cannabis access. Like, why aren't we having a conversation around the production of it here in Ireland? I have an honours degree in herbal science, and I have volunteered, I quite happily volunteer my time to a government programme to get cannabis to patients for, say, at a cost price, where it's not cost government an arm and a leg. Some of these prescriptions are €3,000 every 3 months to fill, or €4,000 every 3 months to fill. That's quite costly.
This is the medical cannabis is €4,000.
Yeah, so that's a lot of money for our state to be paying for that.
And tell me this, What's the reason, I suppose, what's the logic behind the government refusing to allow the I suppose, umbrella term to be inclusive of chronic pain? What, like, you'd imagine that's one of the first things they'd look at if there was evidence to suggest that medical cannabis can help alleviate chronic pain. You'd imagine that'd be one of the first things. Like, what's their logic, or what are they saying?
The one that has the most evidence, but you see that the form that evidence comes in is what they call anecdotal evidence, where it's not actual proper
empirical.
The gold standard double-blind randomized placebo trials. It would be more, say, myself or yourself, we suffer with a condition, we use cannabis, we experience benefits, and then we share those experiences with people, and research is carried out then where it gathers that experiences from people, because people are getting those benefits from the black market for the majority of our history. So it's only in the last, say, 10 years that people are getting proper access to cannabis now through kind of legal avenues. So it's always been operating in the background. So it's been very hard. But the prohibition of cannabis has effectively killed any proper research to back up any of the medical claims. Like, cannabis was actually removed from the British Herbal Pharmacopoeia and the American Herbal Pharmacopoeia in the early 1900s. In an effort to support this kind of war on it, the war on drugs and the prohibition of cannabis, from all those bloody racists in America at the time, it was the Onslingers, and there was a couple of key players there who pushed for cannabis to be made illegal, and they did so quite effectively right across the world through the instruments that were hand formed through the UN. So we've seen there that the UN came up recently in the news then, that the World Health Organization made 6 recommendations in reclassifying cannabis in order to open up access just for patients. And the kind of the UN, they only accepted 1 of the 6 recommendations. And people are celebrating that. And it is, again, like the other announcement that the patients are going to get delivery of the medicine here. And this is worthy of a quick clap of the hands, but like, for campaigners, we need to be ready to go again straight away. We shouldn't waste too much time celebrating this at all, because there's so much more to be done. It's still in Schedule 1 alongside heroin, while other drugs there, like coke, things like that, fall into Schedule 2. It's absolutely ridiculous that we regard a cannabis plant as being more dangerous than some of these chemical drugs that are in the lesser schedules. So there's a lot of ground still to be covered here to kind of remove the stigma around this plant. And that's all it is at the end of the day. It's just a plant.
Well, I suppose the argument could be said that, you know, like heroin comes from just a plant also.
Heroin comes from the plant, but when you go back in history and when opium was kind of used, it didn't have all the problems associated with it as heroin has with it. So heroin, again, it's a human synthesized kind of, it's extracted from the plant and isolated. It's very unnatural, heroin diamorphine in that form. Whereas opium in a natural form, people would consume opium teas and things like that and not experience the same effects as a person who injects or smokes.
There is a culture in Afghanistan, there is a culture of drinking opium tea.
There you go. And it's kind of a traditional thing. It's right and it's ingrained into their tradition. And they don't have big issues there with people having a cup of opium tea and then all of a sudden having a craving to inject it. Like, that's not something that really takes place there. This is something that only came about. This is a phenomenon of the war on drugs, to be honest. Like, when alcohol was prohibited, it encouraged the guys who were making it and moving it to make it more concentrated, because the more concentrated it is, basically, it's more bang for the buck for the consumer, and it reduces the volume that they have to move around. Well, the same thing happened for all these other drugs. You put a prohibition in place around the coca plant, around the opium plant, and you have then these markets that explode as a result of that.
I think it's almost as if it's anything that's psychoactive. that it's seen as automatically illegal. If it alters the state of mind, it's automatic. Everything apart from alcohol.
To be human, because as long as we're human, we've always thought of these altered states of consciousness and experience, you know, through various means, whether it be substance induced or kind of through different practices, even breath work, you know. People have reached these altered states. So it's ingrained in us as humans as well to seek them out. And to criminalise people for that is just so wrong.
I suppose one of the more recent updates. Now, I wouldn't be... Listen, look, I'm waffling here, right? My knowledge is not as extensive as yours now, for example. But I have a massive interest, because I take interest in anything that could potentially be you know, beneficial for people in need, especially when it comes to medication, because for one, we accept the pharmaceutical companies giving us pharmaceuticals and medication and prescribed medication, but sure, some of those medications are 10 times worse, like the addiction to Xanax and to things like benzodiazepine and things like that. Like they're the things that are big money spinners. And I'm seeing now as well, I think there's some patents that has been bought by big pharma companies in regards to the use of cannabis. So, like, they are going to try to corner that market eventually. And I think that might be... It may be that the reason why there's a long wait attached is because, well, at the moment, they can't corner the market because, as you said, it's a plant that grows. Yeah. One of the areas that... One of the areas, though, Martin, that, for myself, that I find... fascinating. I've been listening to some podcasts by Joe Rogan, but I've gone beyond that and I started looking to DMT, as in, you know, like the uses, the cultural uses, because I have quite a lot of friends from Brazil, for example, and one of my life's ambitions is to go to meet one of the Tupi Guarani tribes within the Amazon forest, and they actually partake in shamanism. Or shamanism. Shamanism is what we get when we get too drunk. And we get shamed alive. Shamanism, sorry. More of a tune word. The sham from tune. But no, the shamanism out in the Amazon rainforest. And one of the things they do is they expel the evil spirits and things like that. But it's the DMT. So it's... What's the name? It's the ayahuasca.
Yeah.
But then... Closer to home, and this is bringing me to my long-winded point, we don't have the natural products here, as in for ayahuasca. I think there's two plants involved in that. But over here, we have magic mushrooms. And recently... And this is my question to you. Recently, there's been some developments in the medical world around the use of psilocybin in regards... that's the main... psychoactive ingredient in mushrooms, I think. Am I saying that right? Psilocybin or psilocybin?
Yeah, no, you're right, yeah, psilocybin.
And they've been using that to treat depression.
Yeah, they're using it for a myriad of things. Depression, addiction, that there seems to be a lot of, I don't know, what you call them, like psychosomatic disorders there that people get to address by just using what is it? It's a tool gifted to us by nature. And these things, like, I don't know if you read the Bible or if you're into that sort of thing, like, but it says in that book, you know, that God gave us everything that grows in the earth for and has a use. And I like that, like the ayahuasca and these mushrooms, they're tools. They can be abused, don't get me wrong, but they're tools to, when you use them correctly, you know, if you get a hammer and you could build a house and do many wonderful things, or you could do a lot of damage with it. The exact same to be said for all of these kind of natural plants and mushrooms that occur and the traditional uses that occur. It's crazy when you really get into this war on drugs and the plants and the things that have been outlawed. Like we talk about heroin and opium there earlier, but if people had access to, say, opium and opium teas and there was opium therapies there where we could work with people to try to give them a harm reduction alternative to injecting heroin, this would absolutely be amazing. But these alternatives aren't currently there because of that. The same for people who snort cocaine. If we were able to open up, say, a coca tea kind of lounge where people could come in and they could drink or chew coca leaves like they've done traditionally for thousands of years. We could undo so much harm in our society but by allowing this kind of access.
That's used in Bolivia.
Allow heroin there, or cocaine. You could just allow the plants.
Isn't the coca leaf that's used in Bolivia by the people, so it's for to give them energy and for like
that's also, right, they chew it to deal with the altitudes that they would be working at. It's never been, again, it's not a product of harm in their society.
But then of course not all natural things either should be promoted, because then you have something called scopolamine that grows on trees in South America also. In Brazil it's called Boa-Night Cinderella. Chris is saying something, what is it? Is it Colombia? Oh, well, Colombia is part of South America, Chris. And scopolamine grows on trees all over South America. But it's called Boa-Night Cinderella, which means good night, Cinderella. And it's used in Brazil, for example, by certain prostitutes that would, I suppose, target foreign nationals, and this is something I've been told by Brazilians myself. So there are there's definitely an argument to say that, you know, not all drugs should be looked at as something we should promote, you know, or to say we should be liberal on everything, because I suppose, you know, they can be abused, and if they're abused in certain ways and they're made readily available because it's legal.
But the laws that we create around them should be sensible and not detrimental to our society. So like this scopolamine that you're talking about there, that's kind of that zombie drug basically where they can kind of hijack your mind and make you do things against your will, and they clear out people's bank accounts as a result of that. Well, there's no prohibition that's actually going to stop this kind of activity from happening with that type of plant, because it just grows naturally all over their island and in that area.
But I suppose the argument...
I can't remember exact region, but it is a common occurrence.
I suppose the argument that I'm posing, and again, it's more of a philosophical... Because, look, in order to have an adequate conversation about legalisation or about decriminalisation, we also need to talk about the stuff like this. So, for example, say Ireland 2022, Leo Varadkar, he comes out and, you know, he's all smiles and he's like, listen, lads, you know, let's let bygones be bygones. Look what I'm going to do, Fee. I'm going to promote the legalisation or the liberalisation of drug use for personal use. And all of a sudden then, so we'd have a couple of shops then, because you'd be allowed to distribute it. I'd imagine they'd have to get into the economical side of it, so they will allow for distribution. But granted, it'll probably be licensed distribution, which is fine. But with that, you will see the door open for drugs that would have been listed as illegal in the past, now having a distributor. And if it's been distributed, then surely there will be more of an inclination for people who want to abuse and want to misuse or want to use them for bad. Surely that will rise with the readily availability of the drugs that we're talking about.
You see, I think we're at an important part of the conversation now when it comes to, okay, if punishment was to come and how do these drugs or plants or whatever get regulated within our society and access to be given to them. It is important that if you look at them all individually, so it has to be addressed as in regards to the cannabis. You could say the same for the coca plant that cocaine comes from, and same with opium and all of the above. You know, you have to look at them individually, because it's going to be very hard to have a conversation about regulating drugs when, you know, you need to look at them individually. Do we regulate this plant and that mushroom maybe? You know, because all of these drugs, it's like dogs. It's like trying to say a chihuahua and a Doberman are the exact same thing, and dealing and handling them should be the same. They're much different, you know, cannabis and cocaine, let's say. Like, they're two completely different fish.
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree with you. In actual fact, the type of people who use... And in fact, if you wanted to look at America... A prime example of how it's drug use has been socially constructed over there when it comes to the laws and when it comes to the penalties for drugs. So, for example, an ounce of cocaine, or if you're caught with cocaine in America, you're looking at maybe a year, 2 years maximum, and you probably get off of probation. If you're caught with crack cocaine, you're looking at a 10-year minimum. And I think that there's a huge disparity there when it comes to the type of user that uses crack cocaine. Crack cocaine, traditionally, being in the I suppose, socio-disadvantaged communities or the black communities or in the projects. And this is all based on stuff that I would have looked at online and documentaries and things like that. It's how the law treated two drugs. Now, I don't know the process involved in making crack cocaine, but is it bicarbonate of soda and cocaine and something like that?
But it's just better you're diluting it, and that's kind of the gist of it. They're making it a bit cheaper, and the way in which people use it is a little bit different then as well, and that a lot of the times they would smoke it rather than snort it. So that's a big difference. But yeah, you're dead right in that the laws there, people were disproportionately much more punished there from the black community than the white community. And a lot of the times, I think it's like if you're black and you're caught with drugs, you're like five or six times more likely to be given a jail sentence as a white person caught with those same type of drugs, which is ridiculous. But we can look at that right across the globe. The recent letter on cannabis legalization in New Zealand that brought to light me anyway, that the Maori there, the native guys there, that they're punished up to 50% more than the non-natives on the same island in regards to the cannabis laws. And that's ridiculous. So the Rastas there in Cape Town recently, they were protesting because they feel like they're being discriminated against in South Africa, because, again, as they say, it was the Black Farmers Association of South Africa. They said that the white pharmaceutical companies are the only guys getting the licenses in South Africa to grow the cannabis. So we were talking earlier, and when we started this, that you look into things around human rights, but this whole issue around drugs is actually an issue around human rights, because we've patients here in Ireland, let's say Kenny Tynan, he does a podcast called the Cannabis Patient Podcast. He has a license to get cannabis medicines in Ireland, but it's cost prohibitive. The government won't cover it. So he's not renewing his license now, and he's going to grow his own cannabis and just kind of go that road himself.
Are they allowing licenses to grow cannabis, or does it have to be like hemp?
No, you see, that's the thing. There's no license there to grow cannabis currently. The only way a patient can access it through is this ministerial license, and then they have to go leave the country and collect it in the Netherlands. Some patients get the cost reimbursed, so they have to cover it, and then they get reimbursed afterwards. Other patients, they have to cover the whole cost themselves, as we said earlier, $4,000 every 3 months. Kenny Tynan couldn't afford that. Even currently buying his cannabis illegally now, he's paying much less than the $3,000 the $4,000 every 3 months. It's just ridiculous. So it's discrimination. What's happening here? It's human rights that they're cutting people off from accessing what is a very effective medicine for many, many people. And it's ridiculous when we look at the effects then that prohibition has in our society. We look at the Kinahans, we look at the Hutches, the different crime gangs, the man John Gilligan who was in the news there recently. None of these guys would exist, like Al Capone would never have existed if prohibition didn't help create them. Prohibition is the platform which these guys build their empires, and if we could just take prohibition out of our society, we can pull the rug from under these guys' feet and dismantle this kind of illegal drug trade that happens. If there's an illegal drug trade to happen again in the respective regulation, it's because probably the regulators got it wrong and they overtaxed it, like they do currently with alcohol. Which is something I want to talk about actually as well. When it comes to regulating these drugs, we have to look at the drugs that are already in our society that we've regulated. So we have coffee, which is one type of drug. You know, it's easily accessible. You can walk to the shop and buy it. But people do get addicted to coffee.
Here's one person that's addicted to coffee. I can't have a conversation until I have one.
alcohol, then we apply an age limit to that, and we restrict access. We even restrict the time in which people can buy it, which is, I don't know, you could argue for or against that. I think it's a bit too much. And the same with tobacco. But the big one we've to learn from these industries is that we can't allow big corporations to come in and have profit be the motivating factor in the industry, because if we do that, then that drives up the need for wanting more people to consume your product. We don't want that. We don't want another bloody big alcohol, big tobacco industry when it comes to cannabis or any of these other drugs. We need to learn from that. We need to restrict the kind of businesses that can partake in these kind of things because of the addictive nature and the way in which the people access these things. You know, and again, you have to deal with each plant, each mushroom, each kind of compound individually. But again, we can't allow profit be the primary thing. So for me, I think if cannabis was to be legalized in Ireland, I would love to see it kind of done on a not-for-profit kind of a model where people like get a wage and everything like that, but where the profit goes back into the community. And I would love to see like a 5 or a 10 year exclusionary period where we kind of encouraged the indigenous people, like that, our own people here, like our citizens, to build their own companies rather than what they're currently doing is importing everything. Talk about local industry.
This is an area that I have brought up in the past, to set up a social enterprise model, just like you're saying there now. And under the social enterprise model, to do it as a community-based business, and just like that, to give back into the community. And one of the areas that I had suggested in the past was in around hemp farming. And I was looking at the figures of, say, well, for example, Caoilte, and how they give grants for people to grow trees on their land. And I think for some instances, it's up to €3,000 per year per acre. And I know that's down to a particular type of tree, but at the same time, that is very taxing on the land. Whereas if you were to, say, for example, plant hemp, there's no issue with crop rotation. There's no issue with the taxing of the land. It doesn't take away the nutrients of the soil as much as, say, a tree would, for example. And then when we look at, I suppose, the uses of hemp, we see that there are builders and there's companies across the world that's using hemp to build houses now and to build different types of products or to be used instead of plastic. Like, there is a multitude of uses for hemp alone. And if you were to take hemp as a product then for building or for manufacturing as an aside to the added benefit of having health properties and to be beneficial for people with certain ailments, like it's winning on all counts. I suppose my concern would be, and I know that the response to this is going to be to do with, you know, the lack of regulation, but cannabis psychosis is something that is on the rise and isn't being talked about enough. What's your take on I suppose that on cannabis psychosis?
I don't really know a whole lot around the cannabis psychosis. Kind of what I do know there in regards to that is some people who are predisposed to schizophrenia and other kind of types of mental illnesses like that might see the onset of those a bit earlier. And the same with people who kind of suffered with past traumas, cannabis can certainly bring those up and people can relive those experiences again through that. So certainly cannabis isn't for everybody, and proper education there would help these people who might be at risk to kind of steer clear of cannabis and address their issues in other ways. I think, certainly there's other cases out there where there's people will experience psychosis because of these synthetic cannabinoids and then that being linked with cannabis. There are certain times where that can get mixed up as well.
Cannabinoids,
they're like the K2 and the spice and all that crack.
Spice is an extremely damaging concoction of chemicals. As we've seen, there was a documentary on Vice News about Manchester and about the amount of people who took spice, and it has, like, the long-term effects is neurological and psychological issues were caused. Like, so there is an issue with that, but I suppose there's a golden answer then, isn't it? If it's regulated, you can regulate the type of strain, because of course there's the two types of cannabis, and both of them have, there's a tetrahydrocannabinol, is it? Is that the...
That's the one, THC, yeah.
Oh, see, there I am, name dropping.
Yeah, no, you got it.
Well, but both of them have that strain, and the ones I'm talking about is indica and sativa. Could you tell us a little bit about the difference of both? And maybe the health properties.
Yeah, well, that's kind of a way in which the plants were classified as old. So they were first identified there back in the 1700s by a guy's name of, Carlos Linnaeus, who was this botanist's name. And he kind of identified one species of plant, which was the cannabis sativa, kind of a tall, slender growing plant. But then afterwards, another botanist kind of identified a plant in it was in India somewhere, and he called that then the cannabis indica, and it was short and bushy. And kind of over time now, since the cannabis has gotten out of these environments, the plant is a highly polymorphic plant. So again, just to use the analogy of dogs, you know, once you start, like, all dogs start from wolves. So we kind of look at that from a wolf. You've got chihuahuas, you've got shih tzus, you've got dobermans and rottweilers and everything in between. So the same kind of thing has happened with cannabis now, as it's kind of come out of the natural environment where it evolved over thousands of years, because the traffic from humans would have been slow in certain directions, and maybe the practice of horticulture too, in terms of breeding and stuff like that, it might have been different evolved. And you didn't have the driving factor there of prohibition, which, when it brought cannabis from the outdoor environment, where a lot of the times it got seeded and all of this kind of stuff, you had the kind of introduction of Sansevieria, which is the plant grown without seed, which kind of pushes it to produce more terpenes and cannabinoids and things like that. So over time, the plant has certainly changed. So the indica and sativa is a lot of the times used to simply explain two different effects from the plant. So the early classification of the indica was kind of a more sedative and pain-numbing type of a plant, and the sativa then was more a euphoric, mood uplifting and energetic type of a plant. But as I said, these now have been kind of crossed and interbred, so you can get all sorts of mixes now in between. So the old classification of indica and sativa, it's drifted away now.
And what would be the most prominent one you'd see on the streets in Ireland, for example?
Indica, most likely, because it's like a lot of people want to get stoned, and that's kind of the difference there. They're like, if they look for the couch lock, it's not too soft. People are looking for the higher, the energizing sativas. So there was one good sativa I tested in the past that was called Chocolope, and you could smoke this stuff all day long and you would never feel stoned, but your mind would be just kind of buzzing, like, and not in a bad way, really creative, very positive, kind of coming up with good thoughts and things like that. Like, you know, if you were an artist now, or if you were somebody who was creative at all, that would be the type of cannabis for you. Whereas the indica then is the kind of the more pain-numbing type of one, which again is more common on the streets, because that's kind of the effect people look for more often than the other. At least that is in my experience anyway.
Ah, but Jesus, time for a cup of tea on the Has-Been Show. This show has been sponsored by The Furniture Emporium. The Furniture Emporium is located in Oranmore, County Galway. Go check them out on Facebook, Twitter, and on their website. They do a lot of online sales also. Make sure you check out their Instagram for all the cool pictures they have of all the cool and funky furniture. Check out The Furniture Emporium, Oranmore, County Galway. So welcome back. You're listening to The Has-Been Show, and I'm here with Martin Condon, Stoner Supremo. Is that right, Martin?
Yeah, a scorner and proud, that's for sure.
Or advocate. I'm an advocate. First cousin to Luke Ming Flanagan. Come here, Martin.
I wasn't always, though, to be honest. But I think you were just about to ask this question. But like going back ages ago, I would have been the belief that this stuff would have rotted your brain. It was my cousin who convinced me to try it. Like I never forget, I was on a school bus where we went to school together. And my cousin, he was talking about the hash he was smoking the day before, and I was kind of like, geez, like, what did you want to rot your brain? Why are you going to fall out of school and all this stuff? And then about a week later, sir, I was up in the flats in the Glen hanging out with him, and I tried to have a smoke of cannabis, or hash, at the time, the soap air kind of stuff of old. And I enjoyed it, man, and I've really been reflecting on why I enjoyed it recently, and I think I was kind of self-medicating a bit, maybe. I experienced my thoughts for the first time. It allowed me just to engage with me as a person, you know, if that makes any sense at all. I think all along I've just been kind of in autopilot mode and not realizing, you know, just the reality that existed around me. So it definitely grounded me, and I was about 15 when that happened, and it was just through kind of peer pressure with my cousin. As I said, I wasn't always a stoner or anything like that. I it was actually the opposite. I thought this stuff was going to be bad here, but then I kind of experienced it, and it wasn't. And why I kind of continued on then with this kind of whole activism thing was it wasn't until I was 17 I caught with cannabis. I got caught with a bit of hash. I was out the road with my girlfriend at the time, and we were parked up by the back of the airport, and I wasn't even smoking up there or nothing at the time. We were just chilling, just doing things you do up by the airport, watching the planes land and that with your girlfriend. And we were driving back from there, and the guards pulled us in, searched the car, and I had a bit of hash in the car, and I was brought to court over it. And I kind of went and educated myself then that evening afterwards, but the whole experience was rather traumatic, actually, to be stopped and searched at the side of the road, get out of the car, you know, all your belongings went through, and then to be kind of faced with the prospect of being in front of a judge and your whole future at jeopardy. It's not a nice thing to go through over something as simple as what I believe to be just so benign. Like the hash, it did little harm to me. It actually brought me a lot of benefit. So I suppose
when we talk about the stop and searches, we also need to remember that we cannot blame the Gardaí for doing the job either, type of thing, you know?
No, I don't. Like, but at the same time, would you use the same logic, say, to some of the guys who were pushing the button at the gas chambers? You know, they were just doing their job. They were just following orders.
Where do we draw the line on the orders?
I'd say
on that one, Martin, there's a big fucking difference, you know?
I know, definitely.
You know what I mean?
Recently, we were faced with the prospect of Gardaí entering people's homes because of this whole coronavirus, you know, and people were all up in arms about it, but people in the cannabis community are faced with this reality every bloody day, you know, and it's not fair at all. I know it's not the same as being brought gas chambers, but like, you know what I'm saying is that those people were just doing their job too, and like people were quick to get up in arms when they thought the Gardaí were going to target them because they might have a few extra people over there, or they might be visiting their granny. You know that.
Well, I suppose we need to talk about the culture of searches and things like that. You know,
yeah.
Okay, for example. This whole coronavirus, this pandemic, it was an unprecedented thing. It was, you know, nobody knew that this was ever going to happen. Well, we all had an inkling that at some point there was going to be some virus that was going to bring us to our knees. So lo and behold, here it is. But I suppose what had people up in arms was these new emergency powers, whereas stop and search for you know, having drugs on you or an illegal substance on you, that's something that we've grown up knowing about. We've known that if you're caught with it, it's going to happen. You know, we've been given warnings not to do it. So it's been ingrained into us. Whether it's right or wrong, I totally get your point and appreciate where you're coming from. But whether it's right or wrong, we do know that having that on our person is illegal, and if we're caught with it, there will be implications because of it. I suppose that's the difference between that and Gardaí, you know, breaking, you know, coming into your house and searching your house for people, because they're two very different things. We're just coming to terms with the pandemic, and all of a sudden there was an emergency law trying to be passed where there was a new power to search. So I can see there's a difference there, but I can also see from your point of view how traumatic it would be, especially if you have the mindset that it's medicine, and if it's like being searched for your medicine, of course it's going to be a traumatic experience. But you know what, if you didn't have the traumatic experience, would you be as, I suppose, potent an advocate today?
No, certainly not. But there was a time there where, like, I basically kind of absconded from the courts. I got a year off the road for having €5 worth of cannabis, and at that point, I just lost faith in the whole system because it was a whole sham. I was to court 9 times where I made donations to the charity box, and I got no conviction. So it was just like, man, this whole thing is a money racket. Then I finally got my first conviction and a 1 year ban off the road. And at that point, then I was like, you know what? I'm not going to engage with this court service anymore. The whole thing is a sham. Like, this is my form of protest. I'm just going to disengage myself from it. And I ended up with a bench warrant out for me then for not showing up and not paying fines for judgments that were made in my absence in regards to cannabis possession. Like, that's pretty much the only thing I've been in trouble with outside of, they got me for traffic violations, but it was at a time where I was, like, absconding from the whole system. They wanted me to produce my license, my insurance, and my NCT. The only thing I didn't actually have at the time was the NCT. I had a license, I had an insurance, so I actually have convictions for not producing them and road traffic violations for not producing them. But that was as a result of me just kind of deciding because
did you not challenge that? Because I think
say
that's
that
like that's something that possibly I don't know the legality around it, but that sounds like something that you could challenge, because to be put off the road means that you're a danger.
I can hear these ones around the drugs. Like, so Lynn Rana, a senator there recently, is pushing through a bill on kind of spent convictions, but she's having getting fair kickback on the inclusion of drugs. So in that, like, I can only have one conviction removed every 7 years or something like that under her bill. But, like, sure, I got stopped and searched there 1 year about 20 times, I'd say, and I was caught about 4 times in the same year with cannabis. I was searched 20 times and stung with something 4 times.
I suppose all of these quantities would have been just for personal use?
Personal use, never more than €50.
See, I find it an area that I feel could be done differently also.
Yeah.
Because for one...
What I was going to tell you about there earlier, you were saying would have made me a potent advocate. Well, I was going to actually get to the fact that I'm actually lucky to be here because when I absconded from the law, they put out that bench warrant for me. They caught up with me a whole month even after being looking for me for almost 3 years, okay? They were knocking at my front door now with a warrant to arrest me or to bring me before the courts. And I just told them it was my brother and stuff, like these guys. And they just went away. They just took it. Oh, yeah, no bother. And they went away, like, numerous times. But this one day, anyway, I was in the kitchen. I was poaching some cod from my daughter. I'll never forget the moment. And I just looked to my right, and there I was at the front door, like this big, heavy, grey-haired guard. And he said, Martin. And I just had that look in my face where I just didn't have the time to kind of have a cover story. And I just... It was like, you know what, it's time to kind of, it's over. My back door was open and everything. I could have ran, like, as I say, he was big and heavy. I'm young and fit, I'm a Thai boxer, do training like 5-6 times a week. Like, I was easily outrun him, but I just was like, you know what, I'll go with him, I'll get her over and done with. But that night in Mayfield Holdenfeld, man, like, it was torture. They took everything off me going in there. The rope out of my pants and the string out of my jumper and stuff like that, so I couldn't harm myself. But I actually tied my socks together at one stage, and I was trying to squeeze the life out of my body. Like, I had them around my neck, like, and I was trying to kill myself in the cell. But just throughout that thing, it was difficult to do with my socks, obviously. Like, but I just kind of got myself together, and I just stopped, like... And kind of thought of the other people who would be following. Like, if I were to be successful in killing myself, like, how many other people are going to follow in my footsteps, like, and find themselves in this kind of predicament where it's like, well, they either don't consume cannabis and that way they won't be criminalized for it, But like that's like saying the same thing to a gay man who was criminalised all those years ago. Well, just don't be a gay man, and you won't get criminalised for it.
Well, I suppose, yeah.
It's the same bloody argument. Like, I didn't choose to like cannabis, you know, when I say that. Like, it was peer pressure put upon me. I consumed it, and it was like, oh, fuck, this was better enjoyable. Why is this illegal? Oh, this is not harmful to me. Well, what's wrong with this? Like, you know, like, it was such a beneficial, it was a very positive experience for me. Well, why does any government, why does any law or authority get telling me that I shouldn't get to do this when I can get on an airplane and travel to another European country and do it without the same bloody fair prosecution? This is discrimination, like, and it's a human rights issue, and it needs to end because it's causing so much bloody harm in our society.
I suppose... Yeah, and again, it's devil's advocate work with me at the moment.
No, it's go for it, man, because it's good to hash these out.
Well, of course, yeah, and these conversations have to be had. And look, these conversations are being had, I can guarantee you. Like, there is a bill that's been discussed. Well, it has been discussed anyway for a few years, and they keep putting it back and keep putting it back. And I do know that medical cannabis, that was a discussion that came up maybe 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think that was pressure from a lady called Vera Toomey, I think.
Vera
Toomey, is it?
Yeah, that's her.
For her daughter. So.
Campaign act on her.
Yeah, so she did the long walk, and she got a lot of publicity around it. And with that, then the government started to discuss it a little bit more. But unfortunately, with legislation changes, it takes time, and bills take time to be pushed through. And, you know, you're talking about the people who are going to be voting this in will be elected representatives for every part of Irish society.
Yeah.
And not every part of Irish society is kind of behind the liberalisation of drug use either. So we have to take that...
But they weren't behind abortion or gay marriage either, but we got those things over the line, you know. At least we would have been led to believe that Irish society wasn't supportive of them, but the vote showed it different. And I think if we were given the same opportunity to have votes in regards to our drug policies...
I would agree with you.
We would certainly see an interesting result there, and I think it would be much in favour of...
I would 100% agree with that. I would definitely back the idea to bring it to a vote, because if it's something that's going to be either beneficial or detrimental to Irish society, depending on which side of the fence you're on, because there are detractors on the other side of the fence to yourself, Martin. But if it's going to be something that's going to be either good or bad, then it needs to come down to a vote for the people. And why not? What is the logic and reasoning behind not having this put to a vote? You know?
Well, the reason why we wouldn't get a vote on it is because we only get the vote in constitutional matters. So unless we were going to change our constitution to include cannabis or cannabis medicines or something in that respect, then we won't ever get the vote in this. But what they did in New Zealand was interesting, and I would be very interested to see if we could do it here. Would be a non-binding referendum if the government so wished, whereby we have a vote, but it doesn't actually change our constitution at all. It just enables the government to get the opinion of the public and to kind of act accordingly then in respect of the outcome of that vote. So we won't need to change our constitution. But again, I don't know if there's any kind of instrument or if there's any precedent there for something like that. I know it hasn't ever been done in Ireland, but looking at New Zealand, I think that would be a good strategy to adopt if the government wanted to do something to get the opinions of the public. But what we have coming up there soon would be the Citizens' Assembly. That would be the next closest thing. It's not reflective of the majority of the voters, but it would include 99 people who are registered to vote in the referendum and one judge. And then they would get presentations from both sides of the fence given to them, and they would make a vote then at the end of that, and the government then would kind of adapt strategies going forward based upon the outcome of those votes. So the Citizens' Assembly would be a good thing if our government got their heads out of their arse and actually put a date for it, but they still haven't put a date for it, even though it's included there in the programme for government.
And I suppose, what's your take then on, say, the Portuguese model?
The Portuguese model is good. It's good, but like it's still like I met with Joe Glow. We had him over and done a tour of all of Ireland's not all of them. We done a tour of NUIG UCC and Trinity College in Dublin, so Galway, Cork, and Dublin. We went with Joe Glow, and Joe Glow is the man that basically thought up the policy of decriminalising all drug users in Portugal. And he came over and he gave us a very good and passionate talk and shared with us all of the statistics there, the benefits, the upsides and downsides. It's not all good. And there were certainly negatives as a result of that. But what he said to me, and that's always been in my head, is what Portugal did was a project for the European Union. And he said, and not even a project, an experiment, he said, and that was his words. And he said it was a very successful experiment, and we've learned many things. He said there are downsides to decriminalizing the drug user, because, and he highlighted, it enables low-level drug dealing on the streets, so a person can carry up a 10-day supply. Well, 10-day supply in your pocket, well, that's 10 people for 1-day supply each that you can sell to. So this is how it enables low-level drug dealing. He talked about this, so he said, this does not mean that the decriminalization of the drug user is a failure. It just means that these are issues that need to be highlighted, or they need to be addressed now in the next experiment in Europe to be carried out. And what he called for, and this was in 2016 that this tour took place across Ireland, and it was with Mark Emery as well. But what he called for is for the next country to go one step further to regulate the supply of the drugs, the cannabis and the heroin. He talked about the heroin-assisted therapies. He believes that these were the next steps in the experiment in how do we enable access to these drugs, trans or whatever you want to call them, in our society, and to reduce harm that is caused by them.
Yeah, and I suppose, like, look, it's going to take a bit of time.
I was in Portugal recently. I was in Lisbon, and I got ripped off over there. I was on the street. I done a video about this, but I bought a bit of hash off a fella, and it actually wasn't even hash. It was bloody candle wax and some herbs and spices and stuff that was wrapped together in a bit of cling film to make it look like hash. You give them money to do disappears, and you realise you don't even have proper hash. So this is a big problem over there, because these people know that the drugs are decriminalised. The guy selling it to me said it to me. He goes, oh, it's no problem for you. You can have this much. But for me, it's a big problem. He goes, I have to go because I have too much in my pocket right now. And, they would use it as an excuse there, like the kind of like, oh, yeah, okay, I can sell it to you. Buy this, it's fine. It's decriminalized there. Using it as an opportunity to prey on tourists in some of the busier streets.
Do you remember 2015 in Ireland when the government accidentally fucking legalized all drugs?
I do.
For 24 hours?
Yeah, 24 hours was all it lasted. But people made a big thing about it, all right? It was a big joke. But it just goes to show how effective these drug policies are, really. Like, they're a joke. Like, the world didn't fall apart that day. People just made a joke about it. I think Waterford Whispers, and there was a few funny ads went up on Dundeal there, and events there for big yoke parties, I think, were happening at the time, like, you know. It was funny, like, it was all comical, cheap kind of thing, like, but really, there was a bigger conversation to be had there as to...
Well, to be fair, it started the conversation.
And the sky didn't fall.
Yeah, but to be fair, it did start more conversations. And just, I suppose, just on that with ecstasy or MDMA, that originally started off as couples therapy in the Netherlands, didn't it?
I had an interesting experience with that even myself when I was kind of growing up, again, with my cousins.
Jeez, you'd want to watch these fucking cousins of yours.
we got our hands in some yolks, and we were hanging out together in one of the houses. We talked the yolks, but I became a dad at a young age. And I was kind of coming to terms at that time with handling the idea of becoming a dad at such a young age. It was just not long 17, and my girlfriend became pregnant. And we talked some jokes, and geez, I had some great conversations with my cousins, and I think that really helped me deal with some issues that would have probably ate me up inside, and maybe led to drinking or dealing with them in some negative way. I was never a big drinker or anything, so like when we took yolks back then, it was we would take a yolk, maybe two, and a bottle of water, a box of fags, because you love to smoke fags on yolks.
But I suppose...
But it was just sitting in the room, good tunes, good vibes. And
over the years, though, Martin...
Like, very positive.
I think over the years, I read an article there, oh, it must have been 6 months ago. It was an article about, I suppose, how ecstasy has changed over time. And in the early 90s, yeah. In actual fact, I have a little funny story, not about me taking yolks now, but about I was running a bar in Manchester, all right, in 2006. And I went to, the Pogues were doing like a Christmas thing in the MEN Arena. And the Saw Doctors were supporting them. So the Saw Doctors, whom I know, Leo Moran, gave me a free ticket to go along. And myself and my cousin went in, and my cousin knew the security. And so we ended up backstage anyway with the Pogues and Shane McGowan, Shane McGowan's manager, and the Saw Doctors were there. But I was running a bar, so we said we're going to go back to the bar for a drink. And who happened to walk in but Bez from Happy Mondays? Do you know the band Happy Mondays? Stop twisting my melon, man. Well, so Bez was there. Now, you know, Bez is like a walking pharmaceutical company himself. Anyway, you know, if you were to tap up into his veins, he'll probably, you know what I mean. But he came back to the pub anyway, and he was telling me the story about how they were one of the first people, if not the first group of people, who brought ecstasy into the UK, and that was the early 90s when it became this recreational thing, and that's kind of where I learned that it was firstly used. For couples that were trying to kind of reconnect and show compassion and empathy towards each other. But then an article that I read 6 months ago was telling me that, you know, the actual amount of MDMA, which is that chemical that creates that, I suppose, is a dopamine and oxytocin release. So the oxytocin, oxytocin then being the chemical that, the bonding chemical, or the one that wants to make you hug people and get closer to people and... Well, that has been decreased in the ecstasy tablets that are now available, and they started to put in more amphetamines and ketamine and things like that into the mix to bulk it up, along with some other bulking agents, obviously. So the ecstasy that's on the street today, surely nobody can stand over saying that should be legalized, you know? And again, this brings us back then to regulation.
I'll give you one person who's saying that, and her name is Anne-Marie Cockburn. And Anne-Marie Cockburn, if you don't know who she is, she's a very big campaigner in the UK for the decriminalisation or the regulation of these drugs. Because her story is basically her daughter, what was her daughter's name now, is Martha Cockburn. She was, she's 14 or 15 at the time, and she took some MDMA with her friends at the age of 15, it was. And sadly, she lost her life because the purity of that MDMA was much higher than they expected it to be. And she took maybe 5 to 10 times the safe dosage of MDMA. And especially for a young girl now at the age of 15. But Anne-Marie Cockburn, despite the fact that her daughter does, she advocates for the regulation and the legalization of these drugs. Because she believes her daughter would be alive today if they had proper regulation and quality control there, because she kind of looked into it afterwards and stuff. She seen that her daughter was looking into dosages and things like that. But when you have a powder in front of you, you've no idea of knowing the purity of that powder at all. So sadly, that's why her daughter died, and that's why she advocates for control of these drugs, because when they're in the hands of the criminals, when they get into the hands of kids afterwards, you know, there's so much risk there.
I'll say hats off, by the way.
Regulated, kind of, say that again, sorry?
I was just going to say hats off, by the way, to the people who test the drugs at festivals over in the UK, to let you know
I volunteered with those guys, actually, not the drug testers, but the harm reduction crew, Chill Welfare, amazing, run by a Scottish woman, Katie McLeod, and another couple of individuals there as well within that organisation, really well run. But what they provide is basically kind of crisis intervention for people who might be having a difficult time on different substances, whether it be drink or any other kind of a drug. They provide a space there for people to kind of come and be safe. We help the find people, reconnect them with their friends, or even say if you were at a festival with your friends and say you got into difficulty but you were a bit drunk and not able to mind you either, they could let the security know that, hey, look, we're in a bit of difficulty here. Our friend, we're unable to keep an eye on him. He's not able to mind himself. And we can get you down to the welfare tent, where we have people who understand what you might be going through because they understand the drugs and the effects that
that's
they have.
Fantastic.
And we can relate them to what you'll be going through and help provide them for you, as opposed to a paramedic
What's the name of that group again? What's the name of that group again?
Chill Welfare.
Chill Welfare. For anyone listening. Yeah. It's incredibly important because, look, people are going to take drugs. It's as simple as that. And if there's a likelihood that people are going to take drugs, non-drug users or people in positions of care or security or in positions where they're looking after people, they need to be aware that people are going to take drugs. So we need to have a backup plan as to how to deal with that if something goes wrong. So Chill Welfare. Fair play to you guys.
Chill Welfare. And also check out Anyone's Child as well. That's the organisation set up by Anne-Marie Cockburn. And they have a website as well, like anyoneschild.org. And there's multiple stories up there from numerous parents who've kind of encountered the problems where you know, they've lost their kids or their kids had overdoses because of the purity issues and the quality control. And all these parents are now calling for better regulation around these drugs. You know that the prohibition has failed. Drugs have won the war on drugs. And that's the big takeaway from today's conversation, is drugs have won the war on drugs. It's time to end it because we're just causing casualties now at this stage and there's no need for it.
Yeah. Well, Martin, is there anywhere else that you want to direct people listening to this podcast to? I know you've got your own page. It's called Martin's World. Is there anything else that you'd like to highlight? Anything upcoming or any events or any, I suppose, information gatherings and things like that? Well, not fucking gatherings in the middle of a pandemic, I hope. But any kind of things coming up or events?
There's certainly big things to come in the new years, but all announcements will be made through the Martin's World platforms there on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter and YouTube. So that's where I'll make any announcement. At the moment, there is no dates for any big protests except the 420. So Tuesday, the 20th of April, 420, which is kind of national stoner holiday. I'm already in motion of setting a plan for a big protest in Cork City, and hopefully it'll be a national one coordinated with a group up in Dublin as well, and maybe Galway and a couple of other counties. So if there's any other people out there listening and they want to get involved and they believe they can hold a little protest in their own town, city, village, whatever, definitely get in touch because we need this to happen right across the country of Ireland. Gino Kenny announced yesterday also that he's going to put a bill before the government in the new year to legalise cannabis for adults 18 and over, I believe. But I'd get Gino on to have a chat to see what is actually included in the bill. So 2021 could be a very big year for cannabis, and we could possibly see cannabis legalisation a lot sooner than many people believe, if things go right.
Well, Martin, it was an absolute pleasure to talk to you. I'd love to get you back on the show again, by the way, maybe in 2021 for a couple of updates. Just even to let us know where you're standing, maybe in 6 months' time, or we might get a couple of other guests on as well from other countries to talk about it. So we might be in touch to get some contacts from you. But look, thanks so much for joining us on the Has Been Show. And if it wasn't for me going fucking bald and like an old dirty chicken egg, I'd grow my lovely dreadlocks and I'd show you support through that. But unfortunately, genetics has another way of trying to keep me back. But Martin Condon, thanks so much. And for anyone listening, go check out Martin Condon's page. It's Martin's World. For any information and obviously upcoming events and things like that, anyoneschild.org and Chill Welfare. Check out those web pages also. Martin Condon, thanks so much for joining us on the Has Been Show, and happy, merry, 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 merry Stoner Christmas to you. Thanks again for tuning in to this episode of the Has Been Show. The Has Been Show is available on all platforms. Do check us out on Facebook, which is the Has Been Show, or on Twitter, Hasbeens, at Hasbeens The. If you can, we would really, really appreciate if you could subscribe to our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com patreon.com/thehasbeensshow. The Hasbeens is spelled THEHAZBEANZSHOW. Thank you so much. The Hasbeens podcast is presented by me, Martin Beans Ward. On sound and sound engineering is Chris Jura. Thanks for tuning in. Catch you next time. It's Beans in a pod, but this pod is traveling.